supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. Federal prosecutors announced today they're planning to retry U.S. Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey on bribery charges. As WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, this reopens a saga that came to a tentative conclusion last year.
Menendez and Florida eye doctor Salomon Melgen were accused of exchanging gifts for government favors. Both men denied any wrongdoing. Their 11-week trial ended in November after a federal jury in Newark failed to reach a verdict. Following the mistrial, the Democrat Menendez slammed the FBI and the Justice Department for what he suggested was an overzealous prosecution.
The way this case started was wrong. The way it was investigated was wrong. The way it was prosecuted was wrong, and the way it was tried was wrong as well.
Now the two men are headed back to court. Federal prosecutors asked the judge to set a new trial date as soon as possible. That will make 2018 more complicated for Menendez, who's also facing a challenge to his Senate seat in the fall election. From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Learning a foreign language has been a staple of middle and high school education, but it's less common in younger grades. From WHYY's Delaware desk, Chris Barish profiles a Chinese language immersion program for elementary school kids.
Fifth grader Eve Sabinayagam's favorite color is blue. She's delighted to tell you that in flawless Mandarin Chinese. Her younger brother Nate can chime in too. The siblings attend Freer Elementary School near Dover. The Chinese language immersion program began 6 years ago with a handful of kindergartners. Today, 1,000 Delaware K through 5th graders are enrolled. They learn math, science, and other lessons in Mandarin for half of their day, then work in English the other half. Gregory Fulkerson of the State Department of Education says Delaware's approach ensures that Chinese class is front and center every day.
We really looked at the research that was a part of a lot of music research and the idea that you need daily exposure to both languages in order to really gain proficiency in the languages, especially if that language is not your language that you might speak at home.
The immersion program was championed by former Governor Jack Markell. The goal is to broaden the education of Delaware students and help the state attract more employers in the global economy.
Like, what does that say?
Plant.
What's it mean?
Plants.
Markell started language immersion after a company with call centers in Wilmington and Belgium expanded in Belgium instead of here. The company cited how Belgians generally speak three languages. When Markell went to Utah to observe their immersion program, five Chinese governors were also watching the students.
They were very impressive. And I knew that these Chinese governors were thinking, well, if we're going to do something, we're going to do something in Utah. And I wanted to put Delaware in that position.
Delaware also has 4,000 kids taking Spanish immersion classes. 32 of Delaware's 110 public elementary schools now have immersion programs. At Freer, Principal Julie Lavender and her staff have embraced the program. Chinese alphabet characters adorn walls and doorways, such as the nurse's office. A lobby display case is dedicated to immersion and Chinese culture.
We did a Chinese New Year gala in the years past to celebrate the New Year, where we involve the entire school. We do morning announcements where once a week we highlight the Chinese immersion program students, and they speak in Chinese on the morning announcements, word of the day, phrases, that sort of thing. We have our motto is One Team, One Goal, No Limits, and that is translated as well.
The kids even Skype with peers in China. Shi Wen Li only speaks Chinese to her third graders. Li says her students have been taking Chinese for 3 years. She even introduces new concepts and subjects such as math that the kids haven't yet learned in their native tongue. She reminds herself that the children are, after all, 8 years old.
They're like, the attention span is very short, so if they are zoned out, they will definitely like be lost because they will not catch up with what I'm saying. So I have to use like a lot of the visual aids and to use all like my enthusiasm like to get their attention.
On Li Laoshi's side today, you guys were working with the multiplication table. Does that look familiar to you?
After class with Li, the children are with their English-speaking partner, Lauren Bailey.
We have to be on the same page all the time. I need to know what she's doing over here so I can figure out how I'm going to best support her on the other side. Because sometimes they might not understand the concepts all the way in Chinese.
Bailey's role is critical in preparing the kids for statewide proficiency tests, which are in English.
They need to know what multiplication is in Chinese, but they also need to understand what multiplication is in English.
At Downs Elementary in Newark, teacher Pamela Chang is in her first year with immersion after teaching Chinese in high school for a decade. Chang was a little skeptical that English-speaking kids that young could really learn in Mandarin.
I want to see if it's really, really possible. But once I come into this program, I was just so amazed at how much students can do. They have no problem using Chinese to learn math, to learn science, and social studies. And they have no problem explaining the concept in a Chinese language. And to me, it's just the most rewarding experience I've ever had. When they go outside of school, they are going to have tremendous opportunities waiting for them.
The program will expand next year into middle school. Downs principal Patricia Prettyman hopes her students stay on their immersion path.
That's always the question, you know, that parents may decide other options, but our hope is that most of them will want to continue with the program.
Meanwhile, she'll keep recruiting new kindergartners. Parents are sold, she said, once they tour the Chinese classroom. From the Delaware desk, Chris Barish, WHYY News.
President Trump marks his one-year anniversary in office tomorrow. NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller enlisted the help of Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll, to take stock of how the American public feels about Trump's progress so far.
Frank, first off, did Trump do better or worse than anticipated by the public in his first year?
You know, over 4 out of 10 said about what they expected, but the worst outpolled the better by 35% who said he did worse, 21% said he did better. That's a tricky question because you could dislike Trump and still say, well, I admit he did better than I expected, but I still don't like him. And you could like Trump, be a Republican, and still say, well, I still like him, but he did worse. But what we find when we look at the data is Republicans typically, as expected, skew towards saying he did better, and Democrats skew towards saying he did worse. But the sizable hunk, over 40% of both Republicans and Democrats, said he did about as expected.
Let's turn next to his proponents. What are the defining characteristics, as it were, of the Trump coalition?
You know, I'm probably asked that question more than any other. You know, who are these people that support Trump? His approval rating over his first year is about, you know, 38, 39%, right in that range. So who are these people? Well, the answer is it's not a great surprise. They are Republicans and conservatives. It's not some, in our opinion, new coalition that was just put together by Trump. He's getting the same kind of vote that McCain or that Romney or other Republican candidates would have gotten before him. Now, with that said, even among Republicans, he does better among white Republicans, which are most of them, than he does among the few Republicans who are not white. And within Republicans, he does a little better among men than among women, but not a big difference. So party, that is what you identify with, is by far the strongest predictor of whether or not you approve of the job Donald Trump is doing as president.
Is gender also a strong predictor?
When you take out party and just look at everybody, yes, men are more positive about Trump than women. And that reflects the fact that men, of course, are more likely to be Republican than women. We did go back, however, one of our analysts, and look at the gender gap in the first year for Obama, in the first year for George W. Bush, and in the first year for Bill Clinton. And there was a gender gap there in the same direction. For Clinton, women were more positive. For George W. Bush, men were more positive, like is the case for Trump. And for Obama, women were more positive. That reflects, as I keep saying, that underlying gender pattern in American politics. But our point is that the gender gap for Trump is larger than any of those three previous presidents in his first year. It's about 12 points, men and women, for Trump. And for the three aforementioned presidents in their first year, it was about 6 or 7 points.
We've also spoken in the past about Trump's job approval by religious identity. Has that changed much over the course of the first year?
What I conclude is that there is a big difference in views of Trump by your religion, but it is almost exactly the same difference that we found for Obama, although flipped, and it's about the same difference that we found for George W. Bush, and it's about the same difference we find for party ID. So I don't think Trump has changed anything fundamentally. Mormons, people, the LDS, Latter-day Saints, are the single religious group that are most positive about Trump. And then Protestants, when we put all Protestants together, they're above average. Muslims, the least positive, along with nuns. Those are people who don't have any religious identification. And then people who identify with a non-Christian religion other than Muslims, which would be Jews and other people like Hindus and so forth. They're also below average. But again, that pattern is identical to what we found for previous presidents. I went back and found an article we wrote about Obama a few years ago, and it was a flip. The headline was, Obama does best among Muslims, he does worst among Mormons. And now we're writing the same article for Trump. We're just flipping it. You know, Obama does best among Mormons, worst among Muslims. So not much has changed in terms of the relationship between religious identity and liking a Republican president.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
Hannibal Lokumbe is in his third and final season as composer in residence with the Philadelphia Orchestra. He's working on a new piece, which will premiere next season. To get ideas for his work, he visits prisons. WHYY's Peter Crimmins followed Lokumbe into the Philadelphia Detention Center.
As Hannibal Lokumbe enters the Philadelphia Detention Center in the Northeast, he's already listening for inspiration. He identifies the bars that close behind him as D flat major, a pitch he may use in his composition. He also likes the sound of the heating ducts that are blowing in the prison's gymnasium.
That sound, that's very important because it authenticates where you are.
Lokumbe has his new composition on his mind right now, but he's been visiting prisons since 1974. Lokumbe is 69 years old. He grew up in Texas, still lives there. He's black. And he says by the time he was 25 years old, he had been detained by police wrongly 25 times.
I want to remind the people that are in this prison that they're still human beings and that many of them are here for the reason merely that they didn't have $700-$800 to hire a good lawyer. So how could I, as a human being, turn my back on people? In many cases, I could be among them.
He shares with them the things that he's working on, like a poem he plans to use in his new composition, written on long sheets of tissue paper.
When you sing, my Lord, there is no weeping in the land. The fields are golden with wheat. Mother's breasts are filled with milk.
And he plays some music he's been thinking about. Lokumbe distributes notebooks and pencils to each of the dozen inmates he meets with. He tells them to write down four principles he hopes they will take to heart. Renounce violence, acknowledge the presence of the divine, keep a journal.
And the fourth one, brothers, I promise it'll change your life, is to fall in love with forgiveness. That's the fourth principle, to fall in love with forgiveness.
When he comes back the following day, he hopes the men will share with him something they have written down. For a prisoner like Antoine Reeves, meeting Lokumbe brought about an epiphany.
I had a hard time with forgiving people. And ever since he just laid those words on me, falling in love with forgiveness, I've been able to do it more. As I've been hurt, I've done some wrong to people. And I'm able to, you know, to forgive them, and I want people to be able to forgive me so we can move forward.
Reeves is here in the Philadelphia Detention Center awaiting trial. And he says it's not the first time he's been in jail, but he hopes to be out next season in time to hear the Philadelphia Orchestra premiere Lokumbe's new composition at the Kimmel Center.
I want to go, you know, so, and then I kind of look forward to, you know, maybe I can learn more about the orchestra, because right now I'm a fan of Mr. Lokumbe's, you know, and I know eventually I'll become a fan of the orchestra also.
I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Two more wins, just two more. There's a light at the end of the tunnel for long-suffering Eagles fans, but first, of course, they have to get by two of the toughest teams in the NFL, the Minnesota Vikings on Sunday, and then, if they are so fortunate, the winner of the AFC Championship game. This has been, no doubt, one of the more important weeks of Eagles coach Doug Peterson's career and, likewise, Nick Foles and company. So what about the game plan? Marcus Hayes joins us once again at NewsWorks Tonight. Marcus is a sports columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So, Marcus, guessing it's tough to find a dog mask these days.
Well, yeah, it's really interesting, the phenomenon that the dog mask has become and really how close they were to not needing them. It was 4th and 2, and if Julio Jones is hit by Matt Ryan of Penn Charter, Lane Johnson and Chris Long are throwing those dog masks away. Instead, they've raised over $100,000 selling dog masks for the school district of Philadelphia.
Yeah, well, once again, the Eagles are underdogs, though. This time, was it 3.5 points?
It is. Well, it was, and I think it might have moved to 3, depending on where you look. But, yeah, I mean, there's just absolutely no respect for what Doug Peterson has done. He should be the coach of the year this year. He probably won't be. It'll be Sean McVay in Los Angeles with the Rams. But it should be Peterson. And there's no respect for what Nick Foles has done as Carson Wentz's understudy. He's only won 3 games and one of them a playoff game, which, you know, as you mentioned, he was an underdog there too.
How much did being an underdog help against the Falcons last week, if it did?
You know, this is kind of a strange team, especially now with Nick Foles running it. Even before that, it was kind of hard to put your finger on exactly what they were and kind of hard to understand how much Carson Wentz's athleticism and improvisational skills led them to, you know, what turned out to be a 13-3 season and the number one overall seed. There is, I think, a degree of motivation, but I think that also diminishes the excellent job Doug Peterson has done as the head coach, both, you know, calling plays and setting up game plans and delegating to Jim Schwartz, his defensive coordinator, and really understanding what first Carson Wentz could and couldn't do and understanding what Nick Foles can and can't do.
So, all right, Nick Foles versus Case Keenum at quarterback. Give us a quick sketch of what we can expect Sunday evening.
I don't think either of them will be allowed to lose the game. I believe both coaches, both Pat Shurmur, the offensive coordinator for the Vikings, and Doug Peterson and Frank Reich, who run the offense for the Eagles, will ask them to do what they can do, which means getting the ball out of their hands quickly because neither is particularly elusive. It means giving them simple reads, simple quick reads, not necessarily because they're bad quarterbacks, but because both defenses are excellent. Minnesota's defense is probably the best in the league, and the Eagles' defense is probably the most underrated in the league for how good it is. So I don't think you're going to see either of them pass for, you know, 350 yards and 4 touchdowns. I think both teams would be glad to get 1 touchdown and no interceptions from their quarterbacks and let the rest of the players do the heavy lifting.
Do you think it will be the Eagles on Sunday? I'm asking you to prognosticate here. You know?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I do it for a living. I've done it for 22 years now in this town. I am picking the Eagles. I'd pick them by a point or two. You know, they could win by 3-7, depending on how the turnover game goes. But, yeah, they're a good team, and they're at home. You know, I've been very critical of Eagles fans for different reasons over the seasons, but I've never been critical of their support of their team. They hang in there, and they made a big difference last week. And playing at home, playing at Lincoln Financial Field, it's worth 3 to 5 points no matter who you're playing. We'll see how it goes, but if I were betting, I would bet on the Eagles, certainly with 3 points, but I expect them to win outright by a point or two.
All right, to be continued.
Marcus right.
Hayes, as always, great to have you with us for Newsworks tonight. Marcus Hayes is a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News, and thank you.
Thank you very much.
And as the Eagles get into the zone for the big game on Sunday, many fans will be doing their part by indulging in long-held pregame rituals and superstitions, hoping to squeeze out every bit of luck they can to aid their team. We went around Philadelphia asking Eagles fans what they do to help turn the tide of the game from the comfort of home. Turns out fans are putting a lot of faith in their clothes with varying degrees of cleanliness.
Just hang out with friends, you know, wear the same socks. I got Eagles socks. I wear the same Eagles socks every week.
This year I've worn the same T-shirt every single game this year. I wash it every week, but I wear it every game.
I haven't washed my one Brandon Graham jersey in about 4 weeks. I'll be wearing that.
Oh, boy. And swapping out a good luck charm isn't easy. Take it from fan Lenny Duncan, who recently decided to make the transition from his personalized jersey to official Eagles gear.
This was the first year I felt like, okay, I'm going to try a Wentz jersey. And so I bought three different kinds of Wentz shirts before I built my way up to a Wentz jersey.
And the stakes of the game are being felt here at WHYY as well. WHYY President and CEO Bill Morazzo has joined the heads of local public radio stations WRTI and WXPN to accept a wager from Minnesota Public Radio President and CEO John Taggart. On the line are tote bags filled with homegrown delicacies. Taggart is offering up a spread of Minnesotan-grown wild rice, turkey, and Spam if the Eagles prove victorious this weekend. And should the Birds lose, the Alliance of Philly stations will send over, yep, you guessed it, tasty cakes, scrapple, and cheesesteaks. Nope, that's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. The news director is Eugene Son. Our assistant news director is Katie Colinari. John Musoni is assistant vice president for news operations. Our engineers this week were Bob Alls, Charlie Kyer, Diana Martinez, and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan for NewsWorks Tonight.